Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is Stephen Hunking of Hypno Love Wheel. Hypno Love Wheel was formed in New York City in 1986 and, across several years, recorded a series of releases that gained the band attention in the pages of Spin, as well as on screen via the popular MTV show 120 Minutes. When the group came to an end in the 1990s, the members remained friends. And now, in 2026, there is a new compilation titled Parallel Universe, featuring 15 of the group's most memorable moments, selected by Yola Tango's James McNew. Hunking recently discussed the band's history with me, as well as what it's like to return to business with Hypno Love Wheel after all these years. That's Stephen Hunking of Hypno Love Wheel on Into Music, coming up now.
Well, here we are talking about this project.
I know. It's crazy. I've had a really busy couple of years, and this one is really sweet because, you know, we got the rights back to everything, and it was totally unexpected because, you know, it was kind of something for years. Well, when I say everything, I should say specifically the Alias catalog. We have two... The first two albums were with the buddy, Eamon, who we have a very good relationship with him, so we can put those out and do stuff like that. But Alias, you know, they had it forever, and it was really weird. At some point, like, we even fell off their roster of artists, so we were just kind of in limbo, and the stuff was available, like, on Apple Music, but only... The last album was available on Spotify and other streamers. And, you know, I tried buying it when I had a little bit of money in the early aughts. And that was kind of like, well, nah, we're not interested in selling. And then 2 years ago, on my birthday, very close to this time now, I got an email from Delight saying, do you want your masters back? And I was like, sure. So I made arrangements for my buddy to pick them up. And then I had them and I'm like, do I own these now? You know, because it's like you start to talk to people and they're like, oh, yeah, record labels, they want to just give the masters back, but you don't own them, you know, because they don't want to pay for storage. So then we talked to the band about it. We kind of chipped in for you know, budget kind of entertainment lawyer. And he was like, nope, you got to make sure you own them. And that became a whole year-long process. But through that process, you know, we talked to Alias, talked to Delight, and was like, would you be interested in giving the publishing back too? And she said, sure. So I guess it shows like either the value of Hypno Love Wheel to her or she's just kind of fed up with, you know, having these things around. I think that's probably more of it because she was interested in relocating out of the country and stuff like that. So,
well, I mean, for people who don't know, I mean, you kind of gave us an overview, but sometimes this can be a really prolonged process, and it's sometimes it's like the label isn't making money on it. They don't seem to be interested in re-releasing it, but you're not going to be able to pry those tapes from their or rights from their cold dead hands.
Well, right, because you know you get so. What was interesting, I think, what kind of made a lot of this happen too, and this is just a fact of life. If you're lucky enough to live as long as, you know, most of the band has lived. We did Peter did pass in 2001, our drummer, which was way too young. But, you know, I guess if you're around long enough, you start to, there are limitations on how long people can hold on to ownership of things. So that kind of played into it a bit too. But I think there are ways for people to get around that. The craziest thing was just having to navigate, like, what is it that we're actually trying to own, and how can we afford to find people who can help us put this in legal terms? So there was a lot of, like, I don't know, first lawyer not so great, but the second one was great right here in Portland, and it was a little chat GPT in there, which I'm reluctant to say, but I was kind of like, could you please explain this to me? And it did actually a really good job of it, because then I would go back to lawyer too, and I'd be like, this is what this means, right? He's like, yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I guess there are some uses. I'm not a big proponent of all AI stuff, but for deciphering some kind of legalese, it was somewhat helpful. Yeah. But it's kind of funny because, there was this compilation that was released in Norway like 7 years ago, and which was really lovely, but it didn't have any proper PR push, and it got some PR for just the places that it was sent. But when we were trying to figure out what we're gonna do with all this, we're like, well, we're gonna have a plan. We're gonna treat this like it means something, because it does to us. So we're gonna do like a multi-year project, and we kind of determined the best way to kick it off, since we own this stuff now, was to put out this compilation to the streamers. So we're starting with that. And we did a little video for a demo song that was kind of released 40 years ago, 35 years ago, which is crazy. So it's relatively unknown, but we were kind of like, that's actually a really good song. We should do something with that. So it's kind of funny. It's a cool situation to be in. And there's a lot of reminiscing going on, which kind of is surprising, because I think it's been hard through the years to talk about hypno or too much, because we all kind of moved on from it, and I think there's a lot of, like, it's not bitter feelings towards each other. Those guys are still my friends. We talk all, well, Dave and I specifically talk all the time, and Dan and I talk quite a bit. But I think it's just like most, it's the classic band story of like, we had all these things in place, like, how come we didn't break through? But you start to realize, like, you've broken through in a way that you didn't understand, and it takes you like decades later for people to be like, oh, you're in Hypnolove, you guys made it, We're like, what? What are you talking about? But from a certain perspective, we were very successful. So it's just, I don't know, it's an interesting, from other people's eyes, from ours, it was kind of like, I don't know, what were we? But it's interesting.
Well, I wondered if we could get a little history. So you all kind of found each other about what, 86 roughly?
Yeah. So Dave and I were, we had both relocated to Long Island when we were like in fifth grade, I think, in the middle of fifth grade. So I've known Dave since, I guess, I first met Dave in health class. His teacher, Mr. Probst, and Dave made some wise ass remark. I wish I could remember what it was, but it was really funny. And I was like, I gotta get to know that guy. He is funny. So I kind of became friends with him through that. And then, it wasn't long after that that we kind of met Chris, who's in Duke-Law and was in King Missile. And the three of us were like, just, we're super close. We became super close friends, and we go over to Dave's house in high school on our lunch hour and listen to, I don't know, like Kiss Alive or something. And but then it was like, then he got the Sex Pistols for his brother as a joke, and we were like, this is amazing. And it kind of took off from there, and then we became like these, like, kind of hunted down all these weird records. And then my older sister had a boyfriend who kind of, they moved in with my family. She lost an apartment or something, and he brought all these records, and he had all these like Ralph Records, you know, so The Residents and Snakefinger, which, to be honest, I don't know if you'd see any of that influence in Hypno, but that's a lot of it is there's there. I think there's kind of a quirkiness there to our stuff that's definitely taken a cue, our cue from like deeper cuts or things that were a little bit harder to find. So that's how we met up, and then we were in a, and then we met Dan, who is like two grades below us, but he was even like he was in more esoteric music than we were. Like he just turning us on to all this stuff. So we started a band called The Plastic Device. And that scene was cool on Long Island. That was like some one of the best scenes I've ever been in my life. Like it's this band, The Mosquitoes, who later had a hit with the Monkees reunion. That was then, this is now. And there were all these just like super cool, you know, it was a micro scene. But in that area, it was really big. And anytime you played a club, you know, there'd be like, it would be packed. So we did that for a while. And then, you know, everyone kind of went to college, or art school, or whatever. And somehow in there, we got back together, Dave and Dan and I. And then we found Peter. I wrote a flyer. It said Drummers Wanted. And he thought it was for a drum corps. So he thought he was going to be like, I know, I'm the typo master. So like he was like, he thought he was going to be like a, some kind of cool drum expert. I don't know what he was thinking, but he showed up and another guy showed up too, which was weird, who was trying to convince us to change our name to like the Rhythm Method. And we were like, nah, you know what? And Peter was kind of like, yeah, that, you know, I think he was kind of ranking on this guy. We were like, who is this guy, Peter? And it was as though we knew him our whole life. Like he just fit in right away. So the band like kind of came together on that day. We didn't have a drum kit. Peter was playing on garbage cans, and we could, you know, I could barely play guitar. Some could argue that's still probably true, but I think I have my own unique style. But and Dave was kind of just like a natural, like, musician. Like he could pick up any instrument. Maybe he wouldn't be like the greatest on it, but he understood how it worked, and he could come up with really cool things. So, yeah. And then we went through there and put a single out, and that got to CMJ, and we were kind of like, wow, these, you know, we're fanboys. We just want to do this because we want to do it. And found this old school guy who cut it for us. He used to work for CBS way out in Queens somewhere in Long Island, and like at the end of the train line or something. And then we find out like a couple months later, we had recommended our friends. I think it was Sleepyhead. And they went to this guy. And a week later, they go to pick up their record, but they couldn't get it because the guy killed his wife. So just crazy, like, you know, all these like crazy stories. But we kind of, he seemed like a really nice guy when Dave and I were there. He had this ancient cutting machine and was like teaching us like how it worked and stuff. Yeah, there's, I mean, there's a million just goofy, weird stories that don't necessarily go anywhere. They just kind of pop up and then dissipate. But and then Albert Garzon produced the first two records, along with Scott Hull, who's now was, you know, now is like a Grammy winning, you know, mastering guy. And Albert did the first 10,000 Maniacs record when they were unknown. So we have all these like kind of interesting connections. And then everything on Alias was done with Lou Giordano, who's like Husker Du and Mission to Burma, MIT grad, super genius, super sweet, sweet guy. So we had like super, we had some really amazing experiences, and Alias gave us like good budgets for an indie band. Like the stuff sonically just sounds beautiful. Regard, I mean, I love the songs, but I think anybody, even if you didn't like the songs, or you could be like, that album sounds amazing. Like this doesn't sound like, you know, it sounds like it's for the ages, and it really holds up.
Well, you kind of, it sounds to me like you kind of came along at this moment where if you've been like 5 years earlier, like let's say 78, 79 or something, like
right.
independent music wasn't what it was like in the early to mid 80s, where all of a sudden labels were popping up and
yeah. Well, I think in some ways we were in a weird inflection point on that, right? Because we were almost a little bit late in some ways, and early, and but in other ways, in some ways, we kind of missed the wave in New York, right? We missed that whole wave of CBGBs. We were just a little bit too young, but we knew it was happening. And then by the time, you know, Hypno's putting out records in 87, I guess, you know, there's like Sonic Youth and Das Damen, and I guess Dinosaur Jr.'s around that time starting to pop up. So there were these bands, but even they were like maybe a little bit earlier than us. But, you know, we were definitely in the thick of it when Nirvana broke. Like all of a sudden, any show you did was like an industry show, you know. And that was a weird scene because he'd show up in some bizarre place and it would just be packed with people, like not in suits, but you knew they were there kind of like scouting. So it was kind of an interesting experience to see that happen. But yeah, we definitely, I mean, I think putting out our first two records, you know, I mean, we got written up in Spin on the first one, and then I think the first Alias record we got on 120 minutes, and that was in good, you know, really good rotation there. Then on the second Alias release, we got back on 120 minutes, and like it was just weird. Like we had like success, but I don't think we understood it, because when you're in it, it's like you'll play a really great show, and then you'll end up someplace and like three people show up because, you know, you're in some place where they just haven't gotten the news yet, or they don't know about it for whatever reason, or they're not interested. They want to see maybe a hair metal band or something. So it was definitely, but I think that thing is true of any band. Like, I think if you ask any band that tours, they're like, yeah, we played in 10 people that night, and then we played in front of like 150 the next night. And yeah. So it's a weird business. It's a weird thing.
Oh, sure. I mean, and you could even, you know, I've talked to people where it's like San Francisco, yes, they love us. Los Angeles, right. We can't get arrested. San Diego, we're back on, you know, even in the same state.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and it's funny because we were a New York band, but I think like we were too, I love every band that I, you know, I've mentioned so far, and I love a lot of the New York bands that were around at that time, but there were very few that would like kind of, I think maybe because we were a little bit younger, you know, I don't think we were looked at as peers, although, you know, Yellow Tango was always very, very good to us and still is to this day. Like I was just out in San Francisco joining them for a Hypno song. They, you know, invite us up on stage. So, you know, you get to have this insane experience of being in front of this large audience doing, you know, an old Hypno Love Wheel song, which is great. But yeah, I think for me, like, you know, I had done other things. Like I did my Duclaw thing for years, was in this band Grand Union in Norway, did XL Kings in New York for years, which had some, actually in some ways more acceptable. It was easier to get gigs for that band. But yeah, Hypno was like, I don't think I fully understood until I met this guy in Norway, Frode, who was in this band, I Was a King, who somehow found a single and wanted to work with me on songs. And eventually he was like, oh, I want to put out this Hypno compilation record. So I went back there to promote stuff that Frode and I did, but this album came out at the same time, and people were like, from the States, now playing in Norway, and they're like, you were in Hypno Love Wheel? And I'm like, you know, Hypno Love Wheel, you know? So it's just a weird, it's odd. It's like you're in the fishbowl of your own life, you know, but like there's plenty of information out there on the internet. There are fans out there that are have a lot of nice things to say about us. So it's I love it. It's a great experience. It's like I feel very, very lucky. And I know some people, I know they might feel like, oh, I had this thing, but it kind of tanked, but it never tanked to me. It just kind of had to stop for however long, you know. And then I did other things, and then people still remember it. So because of that band Hypno, I get to do all these other things. So I'm grateful.
So who will be putting the reissues out?
Well, so this is the thing. There's a little bit of it that's yet to be determined. Like, I think since we own it, and talking to some pretty good friends in the industry, they're like, at this point in time, they were like, get your stuff out to the best of your abilities. And as you get it back out there, you know, you can look for, I mean, I this is so weird, it's like a so businessy, but like, you know, you can look for licensing opportunities and stuff like that. But I think right now what we're most excited about is like getting the word out that we're taking on getting all this stuff digitized. We're taking on the process of how we would like this stuff to be treated in the future. Like, we got plenty of material for like extended editions of things, and just to put it out there in a way, and we'd love to remaster all this stuff. So, but we're gonna do it over, you know, a period of years, and we're starting this first one out. It's really our own imprint that we're just doing. There's, you know, I have some vinyl that's left from the first round of this 7 years. It's very small, but that'll be for sale. But this is our, you know, this is our big, this is going to be our big kickoff. So like May 1st, we've got this single that's for a lot of people would be like previously unheard. And we did a little video for it. I should say I did a video for it, but featuring images and stuff from the band. And then the album comes out in mid-June. And there's some other stuff that's going to be happening that's going to be kind of cool, but I can't talk about too much of that before it's officially announced.
Well, I love the fact that you're putting the compilation out first, because I think sometimes these campaigns happen and you get the compilation on the back end. But this is a really great way, because then it's like, oh, okay, well, I like that tune,
Yep.
you know, and oh, that, so that might be like my sweet spot with this band, you know?
Yeah. It's like a child's guide to whatever. It's like, you know, young person. It could be for anybody, but the idea is like, yeah, this is like what we, I mean, we could have done several different compilations, but I think this is like the stuff that probably speaks to the broadest range of like what we did. So I love it. And also James McNew from Yellow Tango did the selection on it, which was very sweet of him. And on the digital side, there's like, I think there's like five or six extras, which is where this single is coming from. So, you know, that's going to be available on Bandcamp. But the other thing is we really want to get it out into streaming. So it's going to be like kind of our first proper push on streaming, which I'm excited about, because the things that were on streaming, like, we're doing fairly well, but there was just nothing. There was nothing behind it, you know? So at least we're giving it this push off, and then for the next 2 years there'll be some periodical, you know, updates, and we're gonna make some effort to promote to promote these.
Yeah, you mentioned James. So your relationship with Yola Tango goes way back, and
Yeah. I mean, you know, we knew James before he was in Yola, and because we knew James because he had a fanzine and he loved the band. And then, which is really crazy to think of, because I don't think of James as being a guy who had a fanzine. But you know, at that point, it was like, oh yeah, this young guy likes us. You know, young guy was like a couple of years younger than us. But then it was probably like, oh, he's so young and he's into our band. He was in this band Christmas out of Boston. That is like one of my favorite bands ever. And that band became Combustible Edison, which was like a lounge cocktail thing. They were huge, right? Yeah. So that went on for years. But Christmas was the rock band before that. And they went through a lot of bass players. And finally, it was James playing with them. And we were like, wow, James is playing with Christmas. And Christmas used to go out and do like they used to do I Dream a Genie, like as a cover in a live show. And I was like, wow, we really made it, you know? Which is so, it's just so funny the things that excite you when you're younger. But that was huge. Like it felt like we had arrived on some level, at least with people like our peers, that we were like, we love this band. And they were very supportive and sweet. And then at one point, James was gonna join us on tour because Dave had to leave the tour because his wife was pregnant and she was having some complications. And but I think it was right around the time where he joined Yo La Tango. So it became like we just did it as a three-piece. But you know, we had this thing where he was like ready to come out, and then this YOLA thing took off, and we're like, wow, he's in Yo La Tango. So I guess that's probably how Ira and Georgia kind of found out about us. So they might have, I think we kind of knew them before that though too. I don't know. We were like in Hoboken, and they were in Hoboken, so I'm sure. And I think Dave knew them really well, Dave Ramirez. So yeah, but our relationship with them go way back. I mean, I've been doing Hanukkah t-shirts for them for 25 years, which is another thing I'm grateful for them for, because you know, I used to do Dan and I used to do the Hypno shirts, and they were ridiculous. Like you know, they were bootleg shirts. Like we did like, you know, scenes from Planet of the Apes or like comic book weird things that we would just kind of steal and alter slightly in weird ways. And I think they thought that aesthetic was fun. So for the Hanukkah shirts, it's been a lot of that, like, you know, Paul Stanley with the Jewish star on his eye, and like Yellow Submarine as a menorah, like all those, like I love stuff like that. And you know, Ira and I and James too is a big part of that, and George is too. I mean, they all are, everyone's involved. But like it's kind of like being like you're running Mad Magazine and you can come up with these goofy things. So yeah,
Yeah.
good life.
Well, just
Lucky bastard.
briefly, two things. One, on the compilation, I love the demo stuff a
Yeah,
lot.
there's a lot of cool stuff on the demos. Yeah, there's a ton of demos out there. Yeah, I'm sorry if I cut you off. I
No,
didn't mean
that
to.
I mean that
No.
was it, yeah.
Yeah. No, the demo stuff is super cool, and that's just like a little chunk of it. You know, we did so we were kind of between labels. And this song that's coming out was released on a label overseas, Munster Records. And, you know, it was a very small run, and it was a very, very long time ago. And a lot of people really haven't heard it. So we're like, well, we're going to put that one out, right? It's a beautiful song. Like Dave wrote this song, and it's a tribute to Sun Ra, which is funny because I didn't realize that. But now that I listen to it, I'm like, yes, of course, that was a tribute to Sun Ra, right? It's a lot of imagery in there, like Sun Ra would use in some of the more space related lyric songs that they did. But yeah, we did a whole bunch of we like Peter was kind of a genius with recording and engineering and all that stuff. So he decided we wrote up all these songs, we did all these songs, and we did kind of lo-fi demos. And then he was like managing a tap dance studio, so he's like, I can get the tap dance studio for the weekend, come in and we'll record in this tap dance studio. They'd have the signs on the walls would be like, check your screws. So I think we named our demo Check Your Screws, right? And the idea was like we were gonna shop it around. But I think at that time, you know, it kind of imploded a little bit for us because Dave had his first kid, and I think it was just too much for us to like the center couldn't hold. You know, it just start you get older, and then you're like, you know, at that point it was probably like 27, and I was probably the oldest member in the band. And you're kind of like, can I can I have a family doing this? And of course, the answer is yes, you can do all those things. But at that point in my life, I think I didn't know. I was a lot like the bird song. I was definitely older then than I am now. Like I didn't have, I had the leap of faith to be in a band and do a lot of stupid things. And then one day it was like waking up and being like, I gotta become an adult. What do I, does that, I gotta wear different clothes? Do I have to work in an office and stuff? So I kind of moved in that direction. And it lasted for a long time, but the music within 5 years of like doing that came right back to me, and I started Duplall pretty soon after that, and just kind of kept it to myself for a long time, and then got it. It grew that audience a little bit, and then all those other bands, and then we had a re the Hypno had a reunion around 2001 for the first Hanukkah show, and then we also played a gig in at the 930 Club in Washington D.C. also with Yo La Tengo, which is weird because they don't really have, except for Hanukkah shows, they don't really have opening bands usually. It's just them. Or unless they're on a really big bill, like with Built to Spill or something like that.
Well, and I think too, like this is also a good time to kind of start all of this up too, because I feel like the music is like, it's not shoegaze, but it appeals to that audience, and it's not like this other punk stuff that was happening, but it appeals to that
Yeah.
audience, you know?
It's hard to really critique your own work. I love everything I do, even the things I'm embarrassed by, because I'm like, well, that was an experience, and I did it. I got up and I put a guitar on and I wrote a song. I did it. And to me, like, I think I'm not, I don't, I'm not like a tortured artist. And this isn't all about me. I mean, Dan's been playing Special Pillow. He put more albums out with that band than he did with Hypno. And he does pretty well with it. Like he has it the way he wants it to be, and it's beautiful. Like it's a really cool thing. And Dave does all these music concrete things that he does. So he's probably the most like out there out of all the Hypno members. And Peter played with Dan for years. So like we all kept kind of doing it, but I guess my point was getting back to like, I think when I hear this stuff, with this many years away from it, I'm like, wow, it's kind of cool. And I could kind of see why we were a weird band back then, because we were like into the DBs and we were into the Feelies and we were into Devo heavily, like anything Devo, like earlier Devo was like, and all that Residence stuff. And also though we were kind of like punks because we couldn't really, we were learning to play. And we were into like the Meat Puppets and a lot of, like the Minutemen. I mean, all these bands you wouldn't probably know if you heard, but maybe now if you listen to some of it, you'd be like, oh yeah, that early stuff does kind of remind me of that. And then so it's a whole hodgepodge of things, but I think at the end of the day, it's 100% the four of us. Like it doesn't, we had four singers, four songwriters. That's a weird thing with a band, and it can be very hard for an audience to like, who am I focusing on? What? And we all kind of had distinct voices, but somehow I think to me, to my ears, all this stuff sounds like a band. But that could be, but I have no idea if anyone, look, I think sometimes by sheer fact of like, if a name has been around for 40 years, people are interested, and I realize that now because people who want to hear about this seem really interested in it. So I'm pleasantly surprised, because it could have just as easily been, what is that? What, that's a long time ago. Seems like just yesterday to me. It's a long time ago.
Yeah.
I'm saying like it was from like, if you're in like 78 and you're thinking, oh, 1938. Like, what? Right? But I don't know. Maybe time is different now. Like, everything's like homogenized and everybody's into everything and everybody has everything at their fingertips with Spotify and YouTube and like, it's just different times. Yeah.
You know, I think it's really cool that those friendships were there, and now you're coming back to this thing that you started all this time ago. It's got to feel
Yeah.
pretty amazing. Like, we never thought that, 40 years we'd be talking about how do we get a distro, a new
Oh
distro.
yeah, no, it's funny because yeah, and it's definitely been like look, this is for whatever reason, I haven't had any, and I'm not saying Dan or Dave or Peter like had any beef with it, but I had like zero beef. Like I think maybe initially when we first broke up, it was like 2 or 3 years where I was like, what was that all about? Like what happened? But I came around to it pretty quickly because it's a weird thing when you say to someone, oh, I was in a band and I toured, I put out records, and if you're really open to that, it can make you feel pretty good about yourself because a lot of like there are a lot of bands out there, but there are not a lot of people that get to say that. And it doesn't make me unusual or special, but it makes an ex like I realize that I have a rarefied experience and I'm grateful for it. And I try to be like humble about it because I mean, what else can I be? I shouldn't be anything but humble about it. It was a very humble success, you know? But like I've always through the years, anytime anyone's ever wanted to know anything about the band, I've been happy to talk about it or, when my buddy Jesse was writing this book on Yellow Tango, he's like, can I use you for quotes in the book? And I'm like, well, he's like, 'cause you know about Alias and they were on Alias. And I'm like, sure. So I talk about Hypno, when I do Duke Law, I give Hypno props, I just like, yeah, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it. So it's kind of cool. And I think Dave and Dan, it's been really fun with them because it is, it's like we're like the old man club, we're like, oh my God, I can't believe how did we get to be this age, and it's like we're not that old, but like you feel like, oh, and here we are still talking about this thing. And it's kind of fun. I'll leave it with this, I was saying to these guys, I'm like, yeah, I'm talking to Jed tomorrow, and he's in Kansas. You're in Wichita, right? So Dave is like, oh yeah, in Wichita, and I'm looking at a note here because I want to get this right. But he's like, yeah, that was the night we were. So that tour, we were going out to LA to record Angel Food, which is probably for me, it's my favorite record we did. That's the second one on Alias. We were going out to San Francisco, so we played the whole way there. So when we got to San Francisco, we were like so tight in the studio, so tight. Felt like, wow, we are a professional, we are a well-oiled machine. Anyway, we had played in Manhattan, Kansas, and in Lawrence. I don't remember what the order was, but we were heading to Salt Lake and we got hit by a storm in Kansas, a snowstorm. I guess it was in 91. And we had to pull over because it was like whiteout at night. And we ended up at this bar called the Wakini, and it had a hotel attached to it. And I think that was in, where was that? No, that was in Wakini. Is there Wakini, Kansas?
I believe so, yeah.
Yeah. So it was a hotel with a tiki bar. So we go in there and proceed to get blotto. We're like, okay, we can't go anywhere. Let's get some tiki drinks, and we got some food or whatever. And I think it was like kind of a Chinese restaurant, but with a tiki bar. So we go, and there's signs all around like, do not bring the tiki cup back to your room. Like, don't steal these tiki cups. And we're hanging out in the room, and we get a call on the phone, and they're like, and we're wasted watching TV, just like, this is so crazy, snowstorm in Kansas, and shows are being canceled. And the person at the front desk is like, "Do you have a tiki cup in that room?" And I won't say which one of us, but they're like, "Yeah." So like, goes to bring it back, and then coming back, goes to the wrong room, and just opens it up, and there are these two dudes in their underwear, just like watching TV, and they're like, "What are you doing here?" But the member of the band who I will not name, I don't want to, I don't, it's not embarrassing, it's just weird, but did make it back to the room. But it was kind of one of these funny things where I'm like, wow, what a weird night. But yeah, so Kansas, we did make Kansas quite a few times, but the tiki story is kind of, it's so innocent but kind of a weird thing that just to this day cracks me up when I think about it.
You've been listening to a conversation with Stephen Hunking of Hypno Love Wheel. The band's new compilation, Parallel Universe, is out on all streaming platforms and downloadable via Bandcamp as of June 19th. At the time of this recording, there is a very small supply of vinyl copies available as well via the group's official Bandcamp page. The group's official Bandcamp page, by the way, is hypnolovewheel1.bandcamp.com. That's where you can find out more about the group, as well as following them on Instagram. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.